My guest at this time is retired U.S. Army Special Forces Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann. He spent 23 years in the Special Forces, served as a Green Beret, was involved in combat deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as several other places. He's now CEO, as well as founder of the Stability Institute. He joins us now to offer his thoughts on the growth of the Islamic State and what ought to be done about it. And, Colonel, thank you very much for your time today.
Hey, thanks a lot, Greg. It's an honor to be here.
You made the point recently that if you put all of the territory controlled by ISIS together, it's bigger than the size of England at this point. When you factor in Syria, when you factor in Iraq, when you factor in what they control in what used to be Libya, talk about the significance of that land and why the fact that it's eclipsed England ought to give us some pause here.
There are differing levels of control that ISIS actually is exhibiting, but you know, at the end of the day, they are certainly expanding their reach. And I think what's important to note about ISIS, Greg, versus Al-Qaeda for your listeners, is these guys are, I think, in a lot of ways more advanced than Al-Qaeda in the sense that Al-Qaeda always talked about reestablishing this caliphate, but I don't think even bin Laden expected to see it in his lifetime. Whereas ISIS, not only have they established it, but they actually, if you read the article in The Atlantic and other articles, you know, the caliphate is part of their legitimacy. So the expansion of this thing is a very real thing, and they are, they're going to keep going on it.
What do you expect next from them? They've obviously got a foothold in Syria and Iraq. Now we see them making headlines, particularly with the beheading of the Christians in North Africa. A lot of folks are saying that North Africa is the jumping off point to really wreak some havoc in Europe. What do you expect to be their next strategy here?
Well, I fully believe that they are looking to expand into Europe and even further. And I do think their activities in Libya and other places, you know, indicate that. I tell you what concerns me is it seems like we keep counting these guys out or we keep dismissing what they're capable of. And the reality is that these guys have a very powerful narrative that resonates with a lot of people. And, you know, they follow an end-of-days kind of scenario here. They are manufacturing a holy war between Islam and the West, and they fully intend to fight it. So I think we've got to be real careful about how we dismiss the capacity of these guys, because at least at the senior levels, they are very ideologically committed to this.
Real quick, your thoughts on the debate this week and in many previous weeks about the administration not referring to the threat as Islamic extremism. You just said ISIS sees this as a holy war. The president says that's the exact reason he doesn't use that terminology. What do you make of the back and forth on that?
Well, I think, first of all, Greg, that you know, the president was right to convene that kind of summit. I do think it is a mistake to not call out the enemy as Islamist violent extremists, because they certainly are, and they are using medieval Islamism to justify their actions. However, I do think the president is right in cautioning us to not fall into the role of the crusader, who they want us to be. That falls right into their narrative, and frankly, that's how they recruit the shooter in Denmark. It's how they recruit these young girls from the UK. This narrative that Islam is under attack by the West by trying to quote-unquote do something, we end up playing into that narrative. So I think we have to call them who they are. We have to look at how they operate honestly and be prepared to change how we go at them, but we need to not fall into their narrative of us being the crusader.
We're talking with the retired Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann, U.S. Army Special Forces, 23 years in the Special Forces, was a Green Beret, deployed in a combat role in Iraq and Afghanistan, among other places, now CEO of the Stability Institute. Let's talk a little bit about how to confront them now. You've stated recently that while it's admirable that Egypt and Jordan are responding to the atrocities committed towards their people, there's only so much they can do. Why do you think they've got limited capacity to really inflict much damage on the Islamic State?
I think there's only so much they can do in the traditional response that they have shown, just as there's only so much we can do in that regard, Greg. If you think about it, for the last 14 years, I mean, I've been involved in this war since it started, along with many others, and really our applications have not worked that well. I mean, I think the emergence of ISIS is proof of that. So, you know, moving carriers into the Mediterranean, airstrikes and drone raids really don't do a whole lot to degrade ISIS. What they actually do is fuel the narrative. Now, You have to do those things. These extremists have to be taken out. There's no doubt about it, but I believe it needs to be done in the context of a broader strategy where we get into these local areas, these strategic safe havens, and we find tribal leaders that are pushing back and resisting, and we help them push them out of there. I think that's the only way for the long term that we degrade ISIS and other extremists to the point where they are irrelevant.
That seemed to be pursued to some extent in the Iraq War last decade and also in Afghanistan. What lessons from those conflicts can we once again use, and what lessons can we learn to say how we might do some things differently in pursuing those alliances?
Yeah, so let me distinguish what I mean here. For example, the last 14 years of the war, where we put hundreds of thousands of young troops on the ground, in all of their battle garb, but then kind of, hand out soccer balls and build schools and do selective targeting, is not what I'm talking about. I think that ends up rendering us as occupiers. What I'm talking about essentially is smaller groups of advisors moving into the areas, the marginalized areas, where clans and tribes are exploited by these extremists who are willing to resist or already resisting and helping them do so. In the last few years of the Afghan War, Green Berets did that throughout rural Afghanistan, and it was very effective. And Mullah Omar was on record as citing it as one of the greatest threats the Taliban faced.
How long does it take to build up an effective force among those people?
It's going to take some time. That's the other thing, Greg, that's not a popular answer, but it's the truth, is that this McDonald's drive-through mentality that we have of defeating these guys, where it happens in a couple of news cycles or a one-year combat rotation, is just it's fantasy. This is going to take several decades to build up partner nation capacity to push back from the bottom on their own. In many of these societies, it took several decades to degrade it, and it's going to take that long to build it back up. But we can do it with less blood, less treasure, put advisors out of these areas, and work bottom up and top down. We have to change how we think, or this stuff is going to follow us home big time.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about military tactics as part of this solution. Number one, we do know that airstrikes are happening, but some reports that we've seen suggest that the number of sorties per day is anywhere from about 5 to 15. Some former military officials saying that should be as high as 1 or 200. How much more damage could we be inflicting there? What makes sense to you?
I've done a lot of research on this over the last 2 years, Greg, again, based on the program that we ran in Afghanistan. And my findings were that essentially the number of airstrikes is frankly irrelevant because it plays into the larger narrative. In fact, Antonio Gustosi, an analyst on Afghanistan that's highly thought of, assessed that we spent approximately $16 million for every Taliban killed in 2005-2006. That's not a very good return on investment when you see the Taliban today. So from a tactical perspective, what makes a lot more sense is getting into these villages and communities, finding those who are resisting, and helping them push back. It's less of an investment, it's more effective, and it's frankly what the enemy is much more afraid of than a bunch of airstrikes that hit clans and families that they're embedded in.
Right now, in terms of additional military response, you just laid out your case as for why large numbers of U.S. troops on the ground would appear more as an occupying force once again there as something just kind of behind the scenes assisting the locals in securing their own homeland. But what we're seeing right now, of course, is the evaporation of the Iraqi military that we thought was pretty well trained last year. And at the same time, you're now up to about 65-68% of the American people who see this threat and think ground forces might be a decent idea now. So what do you say to them?
Well, I don't disagree. We do need ground forces, but I think we've got to get away from, Greg, these terms like boots on the ground, or is a ground campaign needed? It is needed. It's already underway. I think what we've got to look at, though, before we do that, let's take a really hard look at how these violent extremists actually operate. What is it that they do? They go into a fragile state that is basically exploited by violent extremists in the areas that are beyond the reach of that partner government. So, for example, in Iraq, they go into the marginalized Sunni tribal areas where those tribes are degraded and beaten down, and they co-opt them from the bottom up. And so if you strike them from the top down, whether it's with the Iraqi military who those Sunnis distrust, or whether it's with an airstrike, you just drive those extremists deeper into the population like a tick and a dog. And you push the Sunnis further away from the government. So the only way to really come at this is work with the military. Yes, got to do that. But also get into those communities and tribal areas, empower them to move back towards the government as well. And that takes specially trained advisors and operators to do that, of which we are doing none of that now.
You mentioned local tribes. One of the forces, of course, that seems to be quite competent in the work that they do is the Kurdish Peshmerga. Just recently, they reclaimed Kobani from ISIS. How encouraged should we be, not only by their competence, but the fact that ISIS might not be as great as we thought at one point in terms of their ability to keep rolling over the opposition?
Well, I think, you know, those guys are extremely adept fighters and courageous, and they're to be applauded. However, the ethnic tension between the Kurds and the Sunnis is actually leveraged and mobilized by ISIS. So I don't see the Kurds, you know, pushing much further than what they have. But you're going to have to look. You're going to have to deal with the Sunnis. The Sunnis are the marginalized, out of power tribal population right now, where ISIS, frankly, is setting up shop. If the Sunnis were to move back in the direction, a la Sons of Iraq and the Awakening that we saw, you know, say under General Petraeus, I think you start to see the relevance of ISIS diminish very quickly.
Well, we'll certainly be watching. Colonel, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Hey, Greg, thanks a lot, and appreciate you having me on.
Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann, U.S. Army Special Forces retired, spent 23 years in the Special Forces, 15 of those as a Green Beret. He had combat deployments in both Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as several other places. He's the founder and CEO of the Stability Institute. I'm Greg Corumbus reporting for Radio America.